Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Friday, my friends. TGIF, Shabbat Shalom. Hope you're having have great plans for the weekend. Our quote for the day from Dwight David Eisenhower: the supreme quality for leadership is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible, no matter whether it's in a section gang, a football field, in the army, or in an office, a political office. Dwight Eisenhower, our quote for the day. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program coming up on our program today. Brunch with Bernie, our first hour. Congressman Bernie Sanders will be with us. In our second hour, Angelo Codevilla is showing up, a true endangered species, a conservative, critical of Bush's foreign policies. And Jeffrey Kleinman in our third hour, DVD talk, going to be talking about the latest DVDs. And, of course, throughout the midst of all that, the events and details of the day. But first, our first hour of the program, as always on Fridays, Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the longest-serving member, independent member of the House of Representatives, representing the great state of Vermont, now running for the United States Senate from Vermont. And his website, Bernie.org, if you want to call in and speak with Congressman Sanders. He loves to take your calls. We will be doing that throughout most of the show. Our toll-free number across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And you're welcome to drop into our live chat room by going to TomHartman.com and clicking live chat. Good morning, Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Tom Hartman. How are you?
I'm great. Or good afternoon where you are, I guess it is.
It is afternoon.
So, indeed. Bernie, I have an email here from a listener in Vermont who says, Tom, ask Bernie about his Senate Republican opponent buying votes, essentially, by buying computers for students to gain their support.
Well, my...
Is this something that you want
to
pass on?
Well, it goes on and on and on. My Republican opponent is one of the wealthiest people in the state. He will likely spend five times more than any campaign has ever spent in the history of the state of Vermont. He's trying to buy the election. And one of the things that he has done, which upsets, I think, a lot of people, including a lot of teachers, he has sent a letter out to teachers throughout the state, essentially asking them to recruit students in their classrooms to work on his campaign. And that is just not what is done. I mean, you don't inject partisan politics into the classroom, and that is something that is just very, very wrong. If he wants to hire kids to work in his campaign, he has every right in the world to do that. But you don't go to teachers and say, get kids in your classroom, act as a recruiter for a partisan campaign.
I'm amazed he would be that politically stupid to do that.
Well, this guy has so much money. I mean, he's been on television now for two and a half months, and is going to be on morning, noon, and night for the remainder of the campaign. Most Vermonters have received two, three slick brochures from him. It is, an effort to do something that has never been done in Vermont. It's not really to buy an election. Here's a guy who had so much money. He contributed heavily to Bush, and he contributed heavily to Bush-Cheney campaign, to the Republican Party, to many individual candidates for the Senate from around the country, Republicans. And now he thinks he's going to use just unlimited amounts of resources to buy this election. It's an unprecedented event in the state. Frankly, I don't think it's going to work. I think Vermonters resent the idea that somebody is trying to buy an election, and we're doing great. But, that is what's going on. And it's not just here. It's what we're seeing, and you and I have talked about this in many contexts, politics becoming a rich man's game in America, and you have a majority of the members of the United States Senate who literally are millionaires, and others who are working for the wealthy and the powerful. And that's why, at the end of the day, in my view, what goes on in America is the rich are becoming much richer. Tom, I think you may have seen some reports recently about CEO salaries, 400 or 500 times more what their workers are, people getting huge golden parachutes. They're getting stock options worth zillions of dollars. Poverty in America, meanwhile, is increasing. The middle class is shrinking. And that's what happens when you have a government like the one we now have in Washington, where you have the president, the leadership in the Senate, the leadership in the House, all Republican, working night and day for the rich and the powerful and ignoring the needs of the middle class. And, we're seeing that here in Vermont.
Yeah, well, here's another good Republican who seems to believe in global supply and demand. CEO of Exxon, Lee Raymond, testified before Congress. He said, we're all in this together, and the problem is global supply and demand. How can supply and demand justify the kind of salary this guy is getting? I'm boggled. I would think that there's no shortage of a supply of people who would work for $190,000 a day is what they're paying this
guy. Now, you don't want to get my blood pressure too high, do you?
This is incredible. He's got a $400 million retirement package, including a pension stock options, $1 million consulting deal, 2 years using the corporate jet.
$400 million?
$400 million retirement package. And that's not his salary. His salary is $190,915 a day, including weekends. That's $69.7 million a year.
What's the name of this fellow?
This is Lee Raymond. He's the CEO of Exxon. I mean, there have to be people out there who would run Exxon competently for less than $69.7 million.
We really are at a stage, I mean, where in many respects, you know, things are really quite out of control. I mean, I talk, you know, in the state of Vermont, we are a rural state. A lot of people have to drive 50, 100 miles back and forth to work. And paying $260, $270, and the presumption is the price of gas is going to go up and up and up, so that this guy can have hundreds of millions of dollars in his retirement is a complete outrage. It is a complete outrage. And what you're looking at is greed just becoming completely without limit here. So all over the United States of America, you have truckers. I just talked to a family now. They're in the trucking business, small truckers. They're losing money now because the price of gas is going up. Workers are paying more and more to get to work, and this guy is in line to get hundreds of millions of dollars. Meanwhile, you have a president of the United States who came into office along with the vice president because, among other things, their background, their experience is in the oil industry. They know about these things, right?
Sure.
They are experts on this issue.
They profited from it.
Yeah, and their expertise is now leading us close to a $3 a gallon for $3 for a gallon of gas. And meanwhile, you know, what I find humorous here, and I'll tell you what we're trying to do, I mean, but is when gas went up the first time, it was like a test, I think. Then the excuse was that the oil refineries on the Gulf Coast were damaged. It's just too bad that limited production and gas had to go so high. Well, what is the particular excuse right now? Why is gas going up to $3 a gallon?
Well, here's my personal theory on this, Bernie, and I'd love to hear your take on it. These oil companies are multinational corporations. They're not, you know, these are people who travel the world. They understand the world, and they know that in Europe for at least 20 years. I mean, I lived in Germany in '86 and '87. People have been paying $5, $6, $7 a gallon for gasoline, and they simply adapt. And as you mentioned, the trucking thing, a large part of that problem is not so much the increase in the cost of gas, but Reagan's deregulating the trucking industry.
Right.
So that when the price of gas goes up, it whacks the worker instead of the company. But in any case, so these CEOs, these big oil companies, they know that human beings, you know, in fully developed and industrialized countries are able to pay $5 a gallon for gas. And so they're looking at that thing and going, hey, you know, the politicians are going to figure out this out sooner or later. We have to make a they're going to say we need to make a transition away from fossil fuels. They're going to try and get that money by raising a gas tax like they've done in Europe. And we got to get there first. You know, we've got to raise the gas price up to $5 because people will pay that over time. And I think that's the direction they're going.
I think you're absolutely right. And obviously, what the antidote is, if this president and vice president had any concern for the middle class in this country, they would call in the CEOs of the major oil companies into the Oval Office and say, gentlemen, what you're doing is an outrage. It is incredibly selfish. You're hurting millions of working families, not to mention our entire economy. Stop it.
Yeah.
Lower the price of gas right now.
Yeah,
and if not, we will do something about it. Now, we have legislation in which would impose a windfall profits tax. We have legislation in that would give the president the authority to control gas prices. We have legislation in right now that would take action, legal action against OPEC, which, as you know, their very reason for existence in violation of all of these great free trade agreements is to limit production and have artificially high prices. So there are a number of things that can be done to lower gas prices in America. This president and Republican leadership will do nothing.
Yeah, and not the least of which would be reducing consumption by moving to alternatives.
Absolutely. And yeah, I want to mention this to you, just to show you, just give you one tiny example of the potential. We were able to get some money into the state of Vermont last year so that a Toyota Prius would be retrofitted, which it has been. It will be running around the state of Vermont this summer and next winter, and it will have no gas tank in it at all. It will be filled up, quote unquote, filled up with hydrogen, working with the electricity generated by the Prius hybrid, and it will be looking like any other car, going 60, 70 miles per gallon, per hour, and it will have no gasoline in it at all. That's the future of America.
Amazing. Amazing. Good on you. Good on you. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. His website, bernie.org. And check it out. It's a great resource, great news resource. And also, if you'd like to help out Bernie and his campaign, you can go there as well. Bernie.org. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. We'll be right back with your calls at 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yeah, you want some truth? Listen to Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie.org, the website. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Tom Hartman here, the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. 21 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Armin, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie.
Hey, Armin. How are you?
How you doing? I wish you was the president of the United States.
Well, I'll tell you, I wouldn't mind being president, at least just for today, to bring some of these oil companies into the Oval Office and to tell them, you know, that they got to lower prices and stop ripping off the American people. It'd be fun for one day.
I think if we had meaningful campaign finance reform and if the people, the will of the people, the common people prevailed in this country, I think that there's enough people that have enough insight and knowledge and ability that we'd have people like you in Congress as a majority instead of as a minority, and we'd have a utopia society in this country.
Well, Armin, the potential for this country is just extraordinary. Instead of seeing a decline in the standard of living of the average American worker, with all of the increase in worker productivity, with all of the technology out there, we should be increasing the standard of living in the middle class. We should be wiping out poverty. We can have health care for all people. Tom and I were just talking about sustainable energy. It's there, ready to happen. We don't need to be dependent on Mideast oil or polluting fossil fuels. You're right. We have tremendous intelligence, great people all over this country. But the problem is that decisions are being made by these very, very wealthy individuals, these large multinational corporate CEOs who care only about one thing, and that's more and more money for themselves. And what we have got to do, and you hit it right on the head, ordinary people have got to be involved in the political process, stand up, fight for their rights, for their kids, for their parents. We do that. We transform America.
Thank you, Armin. Bob, and thank you, Bernie. Bob in Greenberg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bob, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Bernie. I don't know if you remember back to the 70s and 80s when this thing happened before with the gas prices getting out of hand, really out of hand. And I remember a lot of trucking associations or independent truckers on their own. They literally went two by two up the interstates, you know, and they were not traveling much more than like a school zone, you know, really slow. And it boggled up the traffic, and it made people open their eyes. And
Well, the Teamsters had a strike, too, back then, didn't they?
You know, it's an interesting thing, and Bob raises a very interesting point. And I don't want to be into conspiracy theory, and I don't know the answer, but you would think that the trucking industry, which is being decimated by these huge increases, would be outraged, would be putting pressure on the president, would be putting pressure on the Republican leadership. And I wonder if it's simply a fact that many of these big companies are Republican, and they don't want to embarrass the president. But the core Bob is absolutely right. Sure, I remember during the 70s, the trucking industry fighting back. I'm not hearing terribly much from them right now.
Yeah, and I hear from our truckers who listen on Sirius Satellite Radio, Bernie, that since deregulation, since Reagan deregulated the trucking industry, more and more, probably the majority, I don't have stats, but everyone that I hear from who calls into the program, the trucking companies have recalibrated their contracts with the truckers so that essentially the truckers are picking up the fuel costs.
So they're just passing it on to
the workers. Passing it along to their workers. That's right. And so the trucking companies, they don't care. You know,
well,
they can
people,
use it.
And especially, Tom, I mean, with this outrageous retirement package that this guy from ExxonMobil is getting, I mean, that is beyond belief. And people have got to fight back. And this is an issue, believe me, that if enough people stand up and tell Congress and the White House, they will, in my view, respond.
James in Bakersfield, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello?
Hey, James, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Good.
We were talking a little bit about the trucking industry and a couple points I wanted to make that we really don't live in a free labor market when we have government manipulators such as immigration and illegal labor in this country is one way that, you know, they manipulate the bottom end of labor and the trucking industry is 20,000 drivers short. We talked about that because of the fact they don't pay worthwhile wages. But the government is also manipulating the wages in the trucking industry because they, federal government, state, local government, have free truck driver training programs available. Whereas if the government would just go away and leave us alone, the trucking corporations would have to come to Jesus and start paying a worthwhile wage.
Well, if the government was defending workers, that would be the case. Bernie?
Well, I think a point that James is making is that one role this government, this administration is playing is in a variety of ways trying to keep wages down. And illegal immigration to some degree does it. There are other mechanisms as well. It is not true. If companies paid workers a decent wage, believe me, Americans are prepared to work at any job that's available.
Yeah, and the Bush administration, didn't they just pass a rule that allows Mexican truck driving companies, Mexican trucking companies, to operate throughout the United States?
That's right, something the Teamsters were very concerned about.
Yeah, 27 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
We live in the land of plenty, but many things aren't plenty anymore. Like the water from our sink, they say it's not safe to drink. You gotta go and buy it at the store. Now we're told there's a hole in the ozone. Look what's washing on the beach. And Lord, I believe from the heavens to the seas, we're bringing Mother Nature to her knees. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground.
Indeed, my friends. Let's leave some blue up above us and some green on the ground. Welcome back to our program. 35 minutes past the hour, 25 before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us this hour. Our toll-free number all across the United States, 866-440-8466. And, of course, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, click live chat. Tim in Boynton Beach, Florida on the line. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, Tim.
Yeah, I'd just like to make a comment about this. I'm an independent trucker out of Florida. I haul snowbirds back and forth to your neighborhood. In the last week and a half, my fuel costs have gone astronomical. I have an advantage because I can set my own rates, but these guys that work through brokers, all right, they can't set their own rates. The broker sets the rate that they're going to pay the trucker. Well, when his fuel prices go up and he can't, you know, he can't compensate for the difference in fuel because they're not passing a fuel surcharge on to anybody. If he's got a truck payment of, say, $1,800 a month plus his fuel and his overhead, he's not going to be able to make a living. He's going to end up having to park that truck.
And so he's going to be losing money. The more he drives that truck, the more money he's going to be losing. Is that right, Tim?
Correct.
Yeah. I think we have a very, very, very serious problem. And I think that when we read that the chairman of Exxon got a retirement package worth at least $398 million, this is beyond outrageous. And I think Congress has got to step up to the plate, protect the trucking industry, protect the consumers who are going to be paying higher prices, and protect our economy. So we need some strong action here, and I will be doing what I can when Congress reconvenes next week.
Good on you. Don in Billings, Montana, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. I was calling about they do all this outsourcing for this that they did there for a while. They got rid of all the good jobs. Now they're bringing in all the illegals to take care of the other jobs. I was kind of wondering, what are they going to start doing for the middle-income people and start taking them instead of a lip service that we get from everybody, but nobody ever does anything?
Well, Don, you hit the nail right on the head. What's going on in America now is that in the last 5 years alone, we've lost almost 3 million good-paying blue-collar jobs. I know in my own state of Vermont, which is not one of the great manufacturing centers in America, we have lost about 20% of our manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. And by and large, those are good-paying jobs. And let me just mention what makes me even more nervous is that we are now at the cusp of losing millions of good-paying, white-collar information technology jobs, something we're also beginning to see here in Vermont, because if you have a computer, that work can be done in India, China, Russia, any other country in the world by skilled people at a fraction of the wages that Americans earn. What we are in the middle of, and of course this is something the media doesn't talk about a whole lot, but we are in the middle of a race to the bottom. And that has a lot to do with these unfettered free trade agreements, NAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, and other agreements, which are essentially forcing American workers to compete against desperate people in low-wage countries who often make pennies an hour. Tom, you will remember when the debate took place regarding NAFTA, one of the arguments for NAFTA, I obviously voted against NAFTA, strongly opposed NAFTA and these other trade agreements. One of the arguments for NAFTA is it will control illegal immigration because it's going to create all of these wonderful paying jobs in Mexico, and the people in Mexico are not going to leave that
another
country.
Scam.
Obviously, the very opposite is true. The economy in Mexico is in serious trouble. And one of the things you got the president of Mexico almost encouraging people.
Oh, he's not just almost. I mean, he's publishing brochures about how to cross the border and not die in the desert.
I mean, beyond belief. So
yeah.
Part of the economic policies of Mexico is to urge their people to illegally come into the United States. So, you know, this whole issue needs a real fundamental rethink. And unfettered free trade may be very good for the chairman of ExxonMobil or General Electric or IBM. It is certainly not good for the working people of this country. And our entire economic policies, this trickle-down economic theories, are clearly benefiting the upper-income people whose incomes are soaring. One of the issues, again, we don't talk about too much. It's not just the chairman of ExxonMobil. It is the wealthiest one-tenth of 1% in America who are seeing a huge increase in their income, huge increase in their wealth. And President Bush says, oh, guess what? We will give these guys tens of billions of dollars more in tax breaks so we can run up the national debt, leave it to the middle class, and leave it to our kids and grandchildren. We have got to get a handle on what's happening economically in this country. We need policies to rebuild the middle class. We We need policies to lower poverty, not see it increase. And somebody's got to stand up to these CEOs and these people at the very, very top who are selling out America, whose only concern and religious belief, it seems to me to be, is greed, greed, and greed. There is no excuse, Tom. It is unimaginable to me that when so many people are hurting through high gas prices, that the CEO of a company thinks that he needs $398 million. I mean, where is he coming from? What is that about?
Yeah, well, it's coming out of our pockets.
Well, it is. But the idea, you know, yeah, everybody wants to be rich. But $398 million?
Yeah,
what are you going to do with $300 when you're retiring? What are you going to do?
Yeah.
How many mansions can you build? How many Mercedes-Benz can you have?
Yeah, it is amazing. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I just looked up your website, and the reason was so I could make a donation to your campaign, and I'm almost embarrassed to say how little. But what I'm encouraging is, you know, you are just phenomenal.
Well, I wish I were phenomenal. I'm not phenomenal.
Well, what you have to say just is so wonderful. And I encourage anybody out there, if they can even donate $10, you know, if everybody listening donated $10, it would be an amazing amount of money for you.
Well, thank you. And let me just say this. We receive huge numbers. I mean, thousands and thousands of individual contributions. Some of them are $10, some are $5, some are $50. And we are very appreciative of the fact of that.
And one other thing I wanted to just say, I work for a multinational corporation, and I started in 1995 at a certain dollar amount. If I had the same earning power today that I had then, I would be earning $1.80 more an hour than I am earning. They find every possible way to say you don't deserve a raise. And Bellingham, Washington, I understand, was written up as one of the highest gas places in the country. The other day it was $2.85 a gallon. I'm not sure what it is today.
You guys are really coming close to $3.
And that's for the lowest price gas.
Yeah. Sharon, thank you very much.
Okay.
Let me just say this to Sharon.
Sure.
And I appreciate, you know, Sharon's thoughts. Is what we have got to appreciate, and again, this is something, Tom, why your show and the show of other progressives on the radio is so important, because these issues are not talked about. There is a real attack, coordinated attack, against the middle class of this country. And millions of people are being driven out of the middle class into poverty. Family after family throughout this country, people are working incredible hours. Husbands and wives not seeing each other because they're both working long hours. They're not paying enough attention to the kids. They're living with a great deal of stress. They're getting sick because of the stress and the anxiety of trying to figure out how they can survive economically. This, in fact, is the reality, and it's of what's going on to the middle class. And it's not when President Bush is on television talking about a robust economy, growth of GNP. What he's really talking about is his friends at the top are making out like bandits. Yes, they are doing very well. But he is not talking to ordinary working people, that's for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bernie. In fact, I wrote a book about it called Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class.
That's right.
Coming out this fall. So, Susan in Santa Cruz, California. We have just about a minute before we have to take a break, Susan.
All right. I want to know, there's two things. I want to know if the really outrageous legislation that's passed can be undone with a new president, you know, for instance, Medicare or anti-environment or, you know, legislation that doesn't allow people to sue.
So, Susan, anything that has been passed can be undone tomorrow. Congress can pass any legislation it wants tomorrow, undoing the severe damage that Bush's proposals have brought on America. So the answer is yes, of course.
It would have to be done by Congress, though. The next president couldn't undo it the way he's undone so many things.
Well, you're going to need the support of Congress. Congress passes legislation and the president signs it or vetoes it.
All right. And one other thing is that the gas, you know, Tom, you said that in fully developed industrialized countries, you know, they're used to paying. They would absorb the price of gas. But there's a difference between Europe and here, and one of them is the distances that we have to travel. Like others.
Yeah, and we don't have a good mass transit system.
That's right.
Yes, exactly.
Susan, we have to wrap it up. Bernie, a quick comment. You want to pick that up on the other side?
We'll pick up on the other side.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Susan, for the call. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, Bernie.org, the website for Congressman Bernie Sanders. The Tom Hartman Program, 45 minutes past the hour.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
But if you do right to me, baby, I'll do right to you, too. Got to do unto others like you have them.
Welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment, and our lines are slammed. I want to get back to the phone lines here in just a second, but we're speaking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie, this headline just popped up. The Republicans are planning. We've seen the power of Spanish language radio. It's basically the Spanish language DJs that brought most of these people out into the streets over the last week or two. And now the Republican National Committee is funding ads in Spanish on Spanish language stations. So they won't get it, you know, this won't be covered by the English language media, I would suspect. This is from a Las Vegas newspaper. Attacking Harry Reid for the failure of the immigration bill in the Senate. The last I looked, the Republicans were in charge of the Senate. Am I missing something?
No, you're not missing something. The Republicans control the House. The Republicans control the Senate. The Republicans control the White House. If you like what's going on in this country, thank the Republicans. If you have serious concerns about the direction in which America is going, it is the Republicans who are in leadership and who are making those decisions.
Yeah. Brett in Knoxville, Tennessee. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm kind of a new caller. I don't know too much about how to get my point across, but let me just put it out on the line. I think that companies that have taken our jobs overseas should be required to pay a living wage to the workers that work over there. And a living wage is more than living in a cardboard shack, walking back and forth to work and buying groceries or whatever. It's being able to buy a house and a car and a washing machine and a refrigerator and all the things, have running water and electricity in their house.
Well, Brett, let me just say this to you. A couple of years ago, I was in the Maquiladora area in Mexico on the other side of the El Paso River in Texas. And we visited Mexican workers who are working in modern factories who literally live in cardboard shacks with dirt floors, with maybe one light bulb, getting their drinking water from a common pipe. Workers all over the world are being exploited by these multinationals in a horrendous way. And our job, it seems to me, is twofold. Number one, we have got to stop the outsourcing of good-paying American jobs. Secondly, we have a moral obligation to work with the rest of the industrialized world to see that working people in Mexico and China and elsewhere are not living in desperate poverty. But we do not have to see the middle class of this country being destroyed to help poor people around the world. We can do both. Protect the middle class of America, create decent-paying jobs here, and at the same time, see that poor people around the rest of the world have a decent standard of living as well. We don't have to engage, as the corporate leaders want us to do, in a race to the bottom, which hurts both groups.
Yeah, but helps the CEOs tremendously. Right. Ed in Montclair, New Jersey. Ed, you're live and on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Once again, it's an honor to talk to you. And Bernie, it's especially an honor to talk to you. I wanted to urge you to vote against something that's going to be heading your way called the COPE Act. This is a revision on the Telecommunications Act.
Yep.
And it essentially is going to destroy a concept called net neutrality, which will open the doors up for the telecom companies to begin controlling where people go on the net, how fast they can surf the net, and how much they pay, depending on how fast they want to surf the net. So as a person who does podcasting and has about 6 different websites, I know that this will probably take me off the web because I'll start getting charged for the amount of bandwidth I'm using. I'll start getting charged by the different ISPs for how much bandwidth is coming into my website.
So, Ed, is this a situation where the big guys are going to get bigger and drive the little guys out?
That's exactly it.
Exactly.
That's exactly it. Yeah, bottom line. That's the bottom line, and Ed says it very well, Bernie, is the COPE Act is one that will work tremendously to the benefit of CNN and Disney, and it's going to wipe out any small person who has a website that they're trying to make a living with.
Okay, we will take a very, very strong look at that.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenny, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, how y'all doing? I'm going to try to be quick on this. It's not that the trucking industry don't want to do nothing out here. It's that we don't have any leadership or anybody that's going to rally the troops and say, look, we're going to do it here or we're going to do it there. What you have in the last 5 years since Bush took office is it happened in spontaneous areas around the country. You know, what's going on now is that people say, I haven't been home since January. But that's what we have to do now to try to counter the fuel cost. So I'm just asking you, Tom, if you can do a full segment on it and do the numbers, and you'll find out that it's a lot of companies run out of business. It's a lot of they actually had to buy lots just to keep the trucks that they repo and from guys turning back in because it's just getting tough.
Yeah. Okay, Kenny. Thank you. Bernie?
Well, Kenny makes a very good point that actually it seems to me a segment just on that issue would be very interesting.
Yeah.
And in fact, what I will do is start contacting some of the truckers here in the state of Vermont. See what.
Yeah, and I'll do a little research myself, too.
Okay. Kenny makes a very good point, though.
Yep. Steve in Sacramento, we have half a minute.
Hi. I would like to ask a question that nobody seems to want to talk about. And I'm 51 years old, and for my whole life, all I've heard about is the energy companies, especially the oil companies, ripping off the average American in whatever way they want to do, and with the oil company execs making an insanely amount of profits. Why are we not nationalizing the oil companies and plowing that money into helping our poor and educating the public?
Well, at this particular moment, given Republican leadership in Congress, we can't even raise the minimum wage above $5.15 an hour. But there is no question that we have got to stand up to these guys before they destroy the American economy.
Thanks, Bernie, for being with us.
Okay,
Tom, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment, one of my very favorite. It's always so great to have you with us.
Bye-bye.
Congressman Bernie Sanders' website, bernie.org. Check it out. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital on cable TV systems in 29 states, and of course at AirAmericaRadio.com. Angelo Codavilla is with us. His new book, No Victory, No Peace, is out. He is the senior editor of the American Spectator, professor of international relations at Boston University. And, sir, you describe yourself as a conservative.
Yeah.
And you have a problem with George W. Bush.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. What's wrong with this picture?
Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. That's the point.
Okay.
An awful lot of people assume that that George Bush embodies conservatism. In fact, he does not. But the book that I've written and the article in the American Spectator to which you refer is not written from a consciously conservative standpoint. It is written from a standpoint of a professor of international affairs. And the basic thrust of it is that if George Bush's foreign policy and defense policy is correct, then all of the things that I and every other professor of international affairs has been teaching for the past several hundred years is nonsense.
For example?
For example, the notion of war. Now, war is violence aimed at killing or destroying specific persons and institutions that stand in the way of the peace that you want. Now, in order to have a war, you have to have figured out who the enemy is. You do not make wars against abstract nouns.
Like terrorism.
Like terrorism. You do not make wars while neglecting the fact that those who that the people who incite violence against you, in fact, are receiving billions of your dollars, and you do nothing to cut them off. You do not make war if you simply neglect the fact that you have bases of incitement, et cetera, against you. And most of all, you do not make war by trying to change other people's societies.
Climate change may happen
out of your war, but it certainly cannot be a means of war. In other words, there's just a whole bunch of things that simply do not make sense. If George Bush makes sense, then all of the teachings of the likes of Thucydides and Machiavelli and Clausewitz and the John Quincy Adams and George Washington don't make sense.
Yeah, and now Bush's, the neocon, anyway, perspective behind this thing apparently was, you know, let's politically transform the Middle East through war. And the rationalization that's often put out when I have, at least, let's say, so-called conservatives on this program to discuss the issue is, we brought democracy to Germany and Japan. We fought World War II to bring democracy to them. Why not do it in other places?
That is historical illiteracy. We did not fight World War II to bring democracy to Germany and Japan. We fought World War II to destroy our Nazi and militarist enemies, and we did that very, very well. And having gotten the mule's attention and having destroyed a particular class in both countries, a new class arose. Now, in Germany, it was touch and go whether the Nazis would be replaced by neo-communists. In fact, Konrad Adenauer won the prime ministership the chancellorship, rather, in Germany by one vote, his own.
Mm-hmm.
And we almost discredited Adenauer. We most certainly did not rebuild the German economy. The German economy was rebuilt by the Germans according to views that were fought bitterly by the American occupiers. The notion that the all-wise Americans fixed Germany and Japan, Germany is nonsense. Now, Japan is another story. Douglas MacArthur was able to restructure the country by, in effect, making a deal with the emperor to empower a class which had been disempowered in the late 1920s. What we've done in Iraq here is really something quite different, to try to make a nation out of peoples who have no desire to be a nation.
Mm-hmm.
The Iraqi, there are no Iraqis. There are Shiites, there are Kurds, and there are Sunni Arabs who think that they are the masters of them all.
Right.
To try to make a nation
out of three former states from the Ottoman Empire. British tried it in the 1920s.
Have no desire to be with one another.
Yeah, they had the exact same results that we're having. I mean, they had an insurgency against the British.
George Bush talks about democracy. The Iraqis vote. The vote says we really would rather be separate. And George Bush says, no, you've got to have a government of national unity.
Yeah.
I mean, that's putting the cart before the horse.
We're talking with Dr. Angelo Cotavilla. He is a senior editor at the American Spectator and professor of international relations at Boston University. He has a new book out, No Victory, No Peace, available online and in bookstores all across the United States, essentially criticizing the Bush foreign policy. And I'm curious, sir, what your take is looking forward, if we may, for just a moment. A lot of noise is being made about Iran right now. And we are hearing that, for example, MEK, the Mujahideen organization inside Iraq that Saddam Hussein was funding during the Iraq-Iran war as a terrorist organization against the Iranians. They would infiltrate Iran and blow things up and mostly assassinate people. That this terrorist organization is apparently being funded now by the United States, and that their training camps and whatnot inside Iraq were preserved when we took over Iraq. Specifically, according to this news story that I have here today, this new story that just came out, that says specifically on the orders of Paul Wolfowitz, because Iran is next. Now, this is from 2003, right?
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like
your typical CIA leak. I should mention that for 8 years I was on the staff of the Senate Intelligence Committee,
mm-hmm.
and so I have a certain feeling for these things.
So is history repeating itself?
No, I don't think so. I think this is simply another effort by the CIA to throw mud at the Bush administration, which deserves a great deal of criticism, but I don't think it deserves this. And I also know Paul Wolfowitz personally, and I seriously doubt that Paul Wolfowitz would have done anything of the sort.
Well, what is the situation with regard to Iran?
And besides, Paul was persona non grata at CIA.
Yeah.
I'm quite certain of one thing, that the CIA did not follow Paul Wolfowitz's orders.
Well, this wasn't the CIA, it was the Army, actually.
Of these things would have to be approved by presidential order, and the CIA is really in charge of, even if the Army carries out some of these things, the CIA is in charge.
Interesting.
Statutorily.
Sir, we only have about a minute and a half, and I'm really curious your take on Iran. What do you see playing out here, and how do you think this should be handled?
Look, what's going on, unfortunately, is an awful lot of loose talk, and behind it is really nothing. The U.S. government is not prepared, absolutely not prepared for any military action, despite what anybody says. And number two, it is not prepared for any serious economic sanctions. At most, we're going to have a reprise of the idiocy of the Iraq sanctions of 1992 to 2003.
But if we're not prepared to do that, why are we speaking like this?
Because we have a bunch of idiots running the our foreign policy. That's why. Look, Theodore Roosevelt used to say, "Speak softly and carry a big stick."
Yeah.
George Bush has been speaking very, very loudly, and the stick does not measure up to the words.
He's got no stick at all, apparently.
Well, that's right. In many cases, or the stick, as in the case of Iraq, is used to beat the Bushes.
No pun intended.
Excuse the pun, but not to do anything quite serious. My main criticism is simply a lack of seriousness.
Interesting, lack of seriousness.
A lack of seriousness.
See, my take on the whole thing in Iraq is that I think Bush's primary motivation for this war was political, that he wanted to help the Republican Party and himself. If not, then why did he do this?
No, I know some of these people. Some of them were in my class as students.
Mm-hmm.
No, they're simply much lower quality people than that.
So they did it out of a misplaced idealism?
Out of incompetence. I mean, they thought they were doing the right. The best thing about the Bush people is that they really do mean well. They just don't know how to do it.
Yeah, well, you know,
they fall over themselves.
Yeah, the road to hell is paved with good intentions,
as your
cliche goes. Angelo Codavilla, senior editor of the American Spectator, professor of international relations at Boston University. His new book, No Victory, No Peace. Sir, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
Great speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. A flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze. One leg missing, both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour as we watch the Bush administration and the Republicans in the House and the Senate continue their war on the American middle class. 1,011 days, 11 hours, 39 minutes, 27 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office, barring impeachment. And 21 minutes past the hour. Our phone number, 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartmann.com, click the live chat link. If you'd like to participate in our blog, go to Tom Hartmann or our message board. Go to TomHartmann.com and click message board blog, and you can post your words of wisdom, thoughts, comments, critiques, whatever, right there for the world to see. The New York Times reporting today that when George W. Bush, now actually this is not what they're reporting. I'll share with you what they're reporting in just a moment. I'll give you my commentary on it first. When George W. Bush ordered, or when the Bush administration ordered the EPA to lie to the people of New York City about the condition of the air at Ground Zero, and to lie to the 8,000 or 9,000 people who volunteered to help clean up Ground Zero and the initial rescue teams in the hopes of finding people that could be saved, and then, you know, what turned into a, you know, cleaning up the site. When the Bush administration decided to have the EPA lie to them about the quality of that air and tell them that there was nothing to worry about, those lies are now coming back in the form of dead people. Hear now the story, and I'm just frankly shocked that the New York Times, Anthony DePalma, wrote this story and didn't once mention the fact that the Bush administration has been outed about lying about the quality of the air at Ground Zero. I mean, that just boggles me. But in any case, here's the article by Anthony DePalma in today's New York Times. In the cold clinical language of the autopsy report of a retired New York City detective that was released this week, there were words that thousands of New Yorkers have come to anticipate and to fear. The report from the Medical Examiner's Office in Ocean County, New Jersey, stated, "It is felt with a reasonable degree of medical certainty that the cause of death in this case was directly related to the 9/11 incident." That reasonable degree of medical certainty, coroner language for as sure as I can be, writes Anthony DePalma, provides the first official link made by a medical expert between the hazardous air at Ground Zero after the Trade Center collapse and the death of someone who worked in the rescue effort. This was Detective James Zedroga, 34 years old, died on January 5th of respiratory failure. Now, the Bushies and the Bloombergs and whatnot, they don't want, number one, they don't want their lies to be exposed, or they've been exposed. They don't want us reminded of it. And secondly, they don't want this to be the official finding, because then this guy, this police detective who volunteered for the cleanup effort and died at the age of 34 as a result of damage to his lungs, he will be considered having died in the line of duty and thus be eligible for survivor benefits, which are more than simple life insurance. Dr. Robin Herbert, writes DePalma, who has screened thousands of first responders through the World Trade Center Worker and Volunteer Medical Screening Program, called Detective Zedroga's autopsy report a sentinel event and a warning sign. He said it should be taken very seriously and investigated with great vigor. Incredible. Detective Zedroga's colleagues have argued that hundreds of officers who were also exposed to the dust will probably suffer from a variety of serious illnesses, including a number of blood cancers, because of their work at Ground Zero. The Detectives Endowment Association, their president, Michael Palladino, says that he wants state pension law amended so that Zedroga's death and others like it are reclassified as occurring in the line of duty, qualifying survivors to receive larger benefits. Such a bill has already been proposed in Albany in New York. In Brooklyn yesterday, Mayor Michael Bloomberg noted that a law passed last year allowing city workers who got sick after responding to the Trade Center site to qualify for full disability pensions even after they retire. He called Detective Zedroga's death tragic, but he said the autopsy report may not be definitive. Oh, now the Republicans, they want a second opinion. Yeah, they don't want a second opinion when the Medicare bill sucks. They don't want a second opinion when it's... He says, we'll see what other doctors say. This is what the Republican mayor of New York, Mr. Bloomberg, had to say. More than 7,300 people worked at the Trade Center recovery site, police officers, firefighters, construction workers, and they've joined in a class action suit seeking damages from their employers. One of the lawyers, David Werby, he says over 40 of the plaintiffs have already died. At a minimum, their diseases were aggravated and accelerated by the toxic exposure, he says. Benzene, asbestos, some of these things take years or even decades to show up, or the damage from them. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Working together like spokes inside a wheel, they keep this country turning around. Hello, Kansas, sweet Bill Farmer, let me thank you for your time.
And welcome back, my friends. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. You know, sometimes we have conservatives on the program regularly, and we encourage conservative callers. In fact, I as I often say on the radio, if you are a conservative and if you want to argue with me, you will go to the front of the line. I'll put you on the air. And so it's just a moment, a conservative moment here. For our conservative listeners.
Strong and resolute.
We have a new 12-step program.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
There you go, our 12 steps to recovery from George W. Bush theme music. And I got to tell you, our 12-step program, there are some conservatives who call. You know, usually conservatives call, they make it right on the air. There are some who are just a little problematic. You know, well, I'll let you listen for yourself.
What do you have to say for yourself enabling dope dealers, huh? Ron, where are you going to go when you finally die, Dan, and whoever else is listening?
This is, you know, one of our callers talking to the folks in the studio in New York who are, you know, Juan was there, our engineer, and Dan, who answers the phones, and Alex running the board, and just, you know, what they have to put up with. You know.
And why am I not on the air to ask the most serious question to Tom?
You are on the air.
Who stole the... Oh, really?
Yeah.
Can I archive the Tom Hartman show and hear all the bleeps? Because I'm sorry, if I was on the air, I wouldn't have called you a lying sack of Dan, or Tom, or Juan, or Ron, whoever the is speaking to right now. Huh? Can I archive that?
Yeah, you'll be able to archive it with all the beeps.
Really? Are you telling me the truth?
Yes, I'm telling you.
What do you have to say for that if I'm on the air?
I'm telling you, you're on the air. So it's not.
I'm on the air. Tom would buzz in, and he would also know that he's in very big trouble for clandestinely putting somebody on the air unknowingly.
Nobody's.
That is against the law.
Nobody's clandestinely doing anything.
I think we wanted Linda Tripp to go to jail for that, but that wasn't over the national airwaves.
Okay, let me ask you.
By the way, did Linda Tripp get George Bush impeached or Bill Clinton impeached or what? Could you imagine if Bill Clinton knew that Linda Tripp was recording Monica Lewinsky's phone calls? He would have never got caught in a bald-faced lie. And nobody would have ever known he lied under oath.
Let me ask you a question.
You ever thought about that, on?
Let me ask you a question.
Your loser name is.
What question? Do you want to be on the
air?
Do you want to be on the air?
I called to get on the air.
So you know.
For some reason, I'm boyfriend. Oh, why is that not progressive?
So do you know you're on the air?
If I'm on the air, then Tom's in big trouble.
You know you're on the air?
If I'm on the air, Tom would be weighing in to respond to the question about, you know how much trouble you are putting somebody unknowingly on the air.
I'm telling you you're on the air. You're on the air.
So,
you're on the air.
What's your name, boy?
You know you're on the air.
What is your name, boy?
Juan.
What is it? Don?
Yeah, Don.
David?
Yes.
For the D?
Yeah.
Okay, Don. Do you know how much trouble you are participating in the ruse of putting an unknowing caller on the air and not asking and not telling him he's on the air before he goes on?
Yeah, so our Recover from Conservative Madness segment here. Step one in the 12-step path to recovery. Admit that you're under the sway of right-wing anti-democracy radicals.
Yes, you can do it. You can wake up from being a ditto head. Step two, realize that we can't have freedom and liberty without first building a civil society. This goes right to the heart of these kind of calls. Step three, love democracy's basis in debate and respectful disagreement. Yeah, this does too. Step four in our 12-step program to recover from conservative madness. Understand that a living wage is vital to maintaining a viable middle class. Step five, support labor unions and stop chanting cheap labor as the tired old right-wing mantra. Step six in our 12-step program, stop listening to TV and radio pundits who have amnesia about the separation of church and state. Step seven, stop pretending that you don't understand that government is we the people and not some sort of them.
So since my vote will not be needed, I'll just stay at home and pray.
No, don't do that. Step eight, repent from your SUV and start taking care of the planet we all share. Step nine, stop listening to conservative talk radio. Step 10, help transform America back into an energy independent nation. Step 11, refrain from rewriting political history. And step 12, become a visionary. Participate in democracy. Become a visionary. Instead of calling our, you know, the poor guys who hardworking people in New York who are, you know, answering the phones when folks call in and giving them this kind of.
I was for community college. Did you go to class two today? Huh? Or did you not get into community college, which was your joke? Yeah, funny. Alec, what is your level of education?
I went to middle school.
Uh-huh. Alec, you're a victim of social promotion. That means you grew up on the lower west side of the bell curve. I feel very sorry for you, but enabling a dope dealer is kind of against what God wants people to do for a living, Alec. When are you and Dan and Don going to get real jobs? And when is Tom going to stop polluting the airwaves with vitriol and hateful rhetoric about tens of millions of Americans that happen to be Republican and they're not evil? You don't have a combined IQ that even comes close to mine, so don't try to make funny with me and come up with something original so I can laugh for once when I talk to you f***ing losers.
So since my vote will not be needed, I'll just stay at home and
actually, maybe callers like that should do that.
And why am I not on the air? Why doesn't your boyfriend want to talk to conservatives? Exposing the con and conservatives? Why doesn't he talk to any conservatives? What is he afraid of, Dan? You sure get a lot of callers, don't you?
No, it just has to do with you.
Is your station doing okay for money? What do you guys make doing dope dealing, huh? How much do you make pay you to be a dope dealer? A dope run, huh?
Dope,
what do you make every day, huh?
Dope dealing actually makes a lot of money.
Alec, what do you make, about $40 for a three-hour shop?
It's actually a very, very good business. At least in New York it is.
You're in New York, Alec? Oh, really? You mean in the capital of the liberal capital of the world, you do very well in a metropolis of 20 million people? How come I'm talking to you? How come your lines aren't always busy like all those radical right-wing shows that actually invite and ask disagreeing callers to call in, and you'll get on first if you do disagree with a humble host? But then again, no right-wing shows I listen to preach that Bush is Hitler and Kerry is Stalin. Because
then why don't you call those shows?
You should call them and you should listen to them.
I have Dan and Don and Alec. I've been on the air many a time, but only one hangs up on me.
On it goes.
So since my vote will not be needed, I'll just stay at home and pray.
Yes, indeed, to our conservative friends, 12 steps to recovery from conservative talk radio. 12 steps. And it's a serious, serious gesture, actually. In fact, you can find it on my website there at tomhartman.com, the 12 steps to recovery from conservative talk radio. Fairly straightforward stuff. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, acknowledge the problems that we're confronting. 1-866-889-8894, Carol in Lexington, Virginia. Hey, Carol.
Hi.
I hope you're not going to swear on the air. It's just a little problematic, but
no, I don't swear.
Okay, bless you. I just had to give you and our listeners an insight into what goes on behind the scenes. You know,
well, I'm almost mad enough to cuss, but not there yet.
Okay, what's on your mind?
I've been paying attention to Americans exercising their civil rights and protesting.
Mm-hmm.
And having robocops and other law enforcement officers four deep.
You're talking about when people come out to protest against the war, they show up to protest
against the war and NAFTA and CRAFTA and the other things. We've seen a lot of Americans physically abused by cops and thrown to the ground and cuffed and illegally arrested. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, I was just absolutely stunned watching the march of the Latinos the other day. Where were the cops?
Well, I don't think that
these people are not citizens.
Many of them.
They're here illegally, and they were all in a nice, neat bunch, and none of them got checked or sent back to the country of their origin.
And, well, first of all, we don't have laws in the United States that require people to carry around their citizenship papers, and just showing up on the streets is not a crime. So, you know, Fox News actually had a headline on TV when they were showing that, you know, opportunity to arrest illegal aliens. Actually, it's not.
I don't watch Fox, so
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. But you know, the bottom line is that these were peaceful protests.
Americans have been... had their rights violated.
I agree with you, absolutely.
And I'll tell you what, Dallas and Houston and other major cities like this, these people are not picking tomatoes.
Yeah, well said. Carol, thank you very much. I think you know my position on this, and interesting point. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Yep, you got me. Here I am, the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. On the ground, it's a civil war. This is from the Chicago Tribune. Defining a conflict. The debate over what to call Iraq's war is lost on many Iraqis, is the subhead, as shadowy Shiite militias and Sunni insurgents wage their deadly conflict. Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, we're losing each day, as an average, 50 to 60 people throughout the country, if not more. James Furin, Stanford University political scientist who specializes in the study of civil conflict, he said the conflict in Iraq is a civil war. He said it's comparable to Sri Lanka, the Lebanese War, and Bosnia, all of which were acknowledged to be civil wars. 60,000 Iraqi people, 60,000 Iraqi families have fled their homes in the face of intimidation campaigns by Sunni insurgents and by Shia militants. Basically, what's happening is we're seeing ethnic cleansing. We're seeing people being pushed out of mixed regions and into homogeneous regions or heterogeneous regions. We're not stupid, said Lieutenant Colonel Chris Pease, deputy commander of the U.S. military's police training programs in eastern Baghdad. We know for a fact they're killing people. He said, we dig the damn bodies out of the sewer all the time. But there's a difference between knowing something and proving something. He's talking about whether or not the militias have a major role in the sectarian attack. According to Sunni taxi driver Rod Taha, he said the Shiites don't want us to live together with them. They're made a war against the Sunnis. And of course, you know, the other way around as well. So it's just, this is a full-blown, flat-out, on the other hand, a tragedy. Full-blown, flat-out tragedy. And former Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi to the BBC on March 19th, he said, it's unfortunate that we are in civil war. If this is not a civil war, then God knows what civil war is. That's the former Prime Minister of Iraq. I mean, just the most recent guy. On April 8th, Iraqi Major General Hussein Kamal, the major general in the Iraqi armies. He says, is there a civil war? Yes, there is an undeclared civil war. It's been there for a year or more. All these bodies that are discovered in Baghdad, the slaughter of pilgrims heading to holy sites, the explosions, the destruction, the attacks against the mosques are all part of this. And yet the American mainstream media is still afraid to use the phrase because the Bush administration, they're afraid the Bush administration will jump all over them for it. Yeah. Michelle in Cypress, California. Hey, Michelle. What's
up? Hey, Tom. Long time no talk. Hey, you know how I love your intro music. Well, if you don't, I do.
You mean the bumper music between the breaks?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Thank Louise for that. She picks out that music and does a great job with it.
Yes, she does. Well, I've got a new one for her. I don't know if you've heard it, the one by Pink. It's Dear Mr. President.
And interesting.
Oh, my God, it's awesome. I'd play it for you, but I think there's a thing there, you know, probably at least.
We'll have to beep it, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, I wanted to know, did you see the documentary, The Corporation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I just saw that the other day on Sundance.
Yeah.
I did not know about it, and you'd written your own book on this topic, and it's just like amazing. It's a great documentary, and I just kind of wanted to mention it to people that's out there.
No, it is. It is a great movie. In fact, when they were remaking that for the DVD, they contacted me about filming me to be part of it because of my book on equal protection.
Right.
And we just our schedules collided for a couple of weeks.
Bummer.
It didn't work, and so I'm not in it. But
well, I would have said I've talked to that man before to my husband.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, well, thank you, and thank you again for your voice. And go listen to that song. It'll absolutely move you, especially the lyric part that says, and the First Lady, what would she have said, and something about cocaine and whiskey.
Yeah, okay, we'll check it out. Michelle, thank you very much.
Great to hear
from you.
Mm-hmm.
On this day in history, by the way, I had meant to mention this at the beginning of the hour, President Lincoln was shot today. What a week. Day before yesterday was the day that Roosevelt died. Yesterday was the day Jefferson was born. Today was the day that Lincoln was shot. And that was, by the way, only 5 days after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox, which effectively ended the American Civil War. In fact, that was the event that drove John Wilkes Booth over the edge, according to most historians. That was the thing that just totally, popped his cork. Meanwhile, the Bush administration, speaking of historic events, the Bush administration now seriously, seriously under attack from generals in the United States Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps. Generals, 2-3-star generals. I don't know if we've had a 4- or 5-star general yet, but 1-, 2-, and 3-star general speaking out. The most recent, John Batiste, the retired major general who commanded the Army's 1st Infantry Division in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. He told USA Today yesterday that Rumsfeld should step down because he ignored sound military advice about how to secure Iraq after Baghdad fell. Now, and he did the talk show circuit this morning. He was on a whole bunch of the talk shows, going around saying, this guy needs to go. He was on Good Morning America. He told Diane Sawyer, leaders need to be held accountable. He said, there was 10 years of good, deliberate war planning by U.S. Central Command that was essentially ignored. Marine Lieutenant General Greg Newbold, as Tom Vandenbroek notes in USA Today, former Pentagon's top operations officer, called Iraq an unnecessary war in a Time magazine column this month. Major General Paul Eaton, in charge of training Iraqi troops in 2003 and 2004, last month wrote in the New York Times that Rumsfeld is incompetent and strategically, operationally, and tactically. Army Major General John Riggs told the Washington Post his former colleagues in the military believe Rumsfeld and his close aides should be cleared out. And Marine General Anthony Zinni, the former commander of CENTCOM, U.S. Central Command, said Rumsfeld should retire. But I was saying yesterday, I suspect this is it for Rummy. I don't think he can deal with this kind of pressure. But on the other hand, Melvin Laird, who used to be a defense secretary, says no way is he going to retire because that would reflect badly on Bush. Interesting consideration. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Scotty McClellan. I just, what can you say? I guess it's time for another conservative alert. Yesterday, Scotty McClellan was asked when senior administration officials became aware of a Pentagon report which found that trailers in Iraq had nothing to do with biological weapons. In other words, what did the president know and when did he know it? When did he know it? You know, one of the most important questions. And doesn't seem like there's kind of any kind of answer forthcoming on this thing. To dodge the question, McClellan changed the subject. As Judd notes over at thinkprogress.org, he talked about how the Defense Department processes information, but that's not the issue. The issue is, when did Bush know? If he was out there saying, we found the weapons of mass destruction in this trailer. Now, here's a conversation I had with Scott Ritter back in 2003. Scott Ritter was saying, you know, no way. We were talking about David Kaye. And this was before David Kaye's report was even out, saying that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And Ritter was speculating that Kaye, you know, he wasn't going to find anything. So if he was going to be a good soldier for the Bushies, he was going to have to make something up.
Where I was coming from on David Kaye, he's a man who knows a little bit about the uranium recycling process, and that's it. He's not a weapons expert. He's not a nuclear weapons expert. He's definitely not a biological weapons expert, and I'm a little concerned to hear him talking about uncovering a biological weapons program when it was the great David Kaye who, as an NBC News analyst in April, stood before the world pointing out these so-called mobile biological labs and telling us definitively, there's where the fermentation unit is. This is where they brew up the biological agent. This is where they transfer it. And he was making it all up. It did none of that. It was incapable of doing that. And I think that's pretty much what we're going to get when he reports. The Iraqi scientists who are in U.S. custody have been adamant about, one thing in particular, and that's that there is no weapons of mass destruction program. It had been eliminated. So David Kaye is putting together a case that appears to be cobbled from documentary sources and human sources, walk-ins. None of these walk-ins are going to be key scientists. They're going to be minor engineers who I think have other agendas going on here and historically aren't telling the truth. These are the kind of people that Ahmed Chalabi in the Iraqi National Congress were famous for bringing forward to, my inspection regime when I was there, to the CIA, to Judy Miller of the New York Times. She's noted to her editors that her sources are primarily drawn from the Iraqi National Congress, which means that they are fabricators and liars, and the New York Times has been printing it as though it's fact. And I'm afraid that David Kaye is going to be presenting things as if they're fact. He will not present physical evidence of a biological weapons program. He will be presenting a document-based circumstantial case with a lot of human statements that cannot be sustained with, factual solid evidence.
So that Scott Ritter back in 2003, talking on this program, talking with us about the possibility that David Kaye's report may be coming. David Kaye, commissioned by the Bush administration to go over there, find those weapons of mass destruction, spend $1 billion, find those weapons of mass destruction, scrubbed the country. I mean, they probably could have rebuilt the electrical grid for that. It's just incredible. And as Scott Ritter pointed out, in April of 2003, now keep in mind, it was May of 2003 when Bush declared mission accomplished, May 1st on the aircraft carrier. It was May 27th when he received the report that these so-called mobile labs were exactly what Scott Ritter had predicted on this program almost a year earlier. Unfortunately, I don't have the archive of that because it was before we were archiving the show.
or every single show. But, you know, he unambiguously had been on this program and said, those are for weather balloons. And I remember asking him, weather balloons? Why would anybody build a big mobile trailer for a weather balloon? And he said, it's for artillery. He said, you need to sight your artillery. If you're going to fire a shell, you know, the size of a small car, I mean, if you're going to fire a giant shell a mile away or 5 miles away or whatever the distance is, you've got to get that thing high enough. And if you're going to get it high enough, you got to know which way the wind is blowing so that you can calibrate your artillery. This is nothing new. This is no secret. Everybody in the military knows this. And in order to get that, to figure out which way the wind is blowing, you've got to get a weather balloon up there or a balloon. And you sight the balloon, you notice which way the wind is blowing when you send the balloon up. And then based on which way the wind is blowing, when you send the balloon up, you say, oh, okay, this is how we move that artillery cannon, 1.5 degrees to the right or to the left or whatever, or up or down. And he said, we know that these trailers are there. He said, as part of the UN inspection team, he identified them. He inspected them. Yes, they have fermenters in them. They use an enzymatic process to create hydrogen. But they're incapable of producing biological warfare agents. They produce hydrogen for balloons. And the Bush administration knew this. They didn't even need a report from, I mean, everybody's, this is the thing that just gets me the about the mainstream media on this. Where, I mean, the MSNBC, Chris Matthews, all right on down the list. I mean, CBS, ABC, all of them. ABC actually, came right out and said the other day, well, Bush knew when he said on Polish television, we have found the weapons of mass destruction. He knew that that was not the case. Okay, so you've got Bush saying that, and for all practical purposes, well, not for all practical purposes. I mean, it was just simply coming right out and saying it.
We found the weapons of mass destruction. We found biological laboratories. But for those who say we haven't found the banned manufacturing devices or banned weapons, they're wrong. We found them.
Now, Bush saying that, according to ABC News, he knew at the time that that wasn't the case because 2 days earlier the Pentagon had told him that. Well, I would submit to you, and I think if the mainstream media did just the very smallest amount of digging, Bush knew at the time that that couldn't be the case because they had known since 1997 when Scott Ritter was over there that there were these mobile gas-producing units and that they were there to produce gas for weather balloons. They knew it all along. So it's just, and this is, David Kay was trying to hype these things, and then he got, a very good, very healthy paycheck, thank you very much, for going to Iraq, and ultimately decided he couldn't lie. It wouldn't hold up. There was no way he could put together a lie. There were too many people involved. It was too obvious. There was nothing there. There was no there there. And so I'm just waiting for the mainstream media to say to Bush or to somebody in the Bush administration, McClellan, whatever, these trailers that you guys were identifying as mobile biological weapons labs had been identified back in the 90s by Scott Ritter and the UN inspection team as being to produce hydrogen for weather balloons. We have known that all along. They were identified. Saddam Hussein was, these are for our weather balloons. For sighting our artillery. And yet Bush is still out there going, oh, no, that's not what it's all about. Amazing. Larry in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Larry.
Excellent. Yes, Tom, my background includes 8 years on board nuclear submarines in the 70s, 5 years training the Pershing II missile repairman during the 80s, and 5 years working in the shipyard as a navigation supervisor here in Seattle during the 90s. My concern with Iran is their ability to respond. You recall back in the August of 2000 when the submarine Kursk went down in the Barents Sea, it was testing a torpedo rocket called the Skval or the Skval, S-K-V-A-L, which is a torpedo that is capable of doing 250 knots due to a phenomenon called supercavitation.
Right.
This torpedo rocket has been developed further by the Chinese. They've included ring laser gyro systems in it.
And now they've sold it to the Iranians.
And it's now called the Hoot.
Right.
Or the Whale.
Larry, I'm going to have to ask you to hold on. I thought your comment was going to be shorter than this, but I would like to get to it. Can you hold on for just a second?
Sure.
We'll take a break here. It's a fine thing that we have to pay the bills. It keeps the show on the air. And we will be right back. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplanes. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn works if its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up a notch. Speed front. No strength. The matter starts to clatter with fear. Fight down. High fire in a fire.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. You're the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no RNC passes. Larry, in Seattle, you were saying you are concerned that if we strike Iran, that unlike Iraq, they have the means to respond. Is that the gist of the point that you were making?
Yes, all along their coast on the Persian Gulf, they've emplaced Silkworm anti-ship missiles capable of reaching just about every ship in the Persian Gulf. They've said that they are keeping the option open to close down the Straits of Hormuz, which is a very small area that can be closed down rather quickly just by sinking a couple of large tanker ships in that region. They maintain these new torpedo rockets that have a capability of 250 knots, which is a lot faster than much of what we could respond to, and there's not a whole lot of room in the Persian Gulf for our Navy to maneuver. So it would seem to me that it would not take too long for a barrel of oil to reach at least $200 a barrel and gasoline prices to shoot to $10 a gallon.
If we attacked Iran.
If we attack Iran.
Yeah, not to mention the possibility of World War III breaking out because the entire Islamic world would explode.
Well, the Chinese are very interested in Iran because that's their proxy country right now for testing their weapon systems.
Yeah. Interesting. Larry, thank you very much. Good to
hear. You're welcome, Tom.
And I appreciate your perspective and your expertise. Jeffrey Kleinman is with us with DVDtalk.com, the online magazine about DVDs and what's available. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, how's it going?
Just great. Just great. Glad to have you with us. Fun with Dick and Jane has just come out on DVD.
Yeah, this is a movie with Jim Carrey and T. Leon. It's interesting when corporate scandal moves into the comic spoof space, and you know that it's kind of really entered our culture when you've got a movie basically that looks at a company like Enron and is a comedy about, okay, so what happens to people when they have their life destroyed by a big company that they get, you know, their 401k is depleted and everything. And, you know, of course, the answer is rob banks.
Yeah. Yeah. It was Louise and I actually saw this movie and when it was in the theaters. And it's good, dumb fun. You know, it's but your point that the larger kind of post Enron message, good one. I understand that the Ironweed Progressive Film Club April edition of Street Fight is coming out, an Academy Award nominated documentary.
Right, Street Fight is this great documentary that, and this is why I'm a big fan of this Progressive Film Club, because they put out films like this that just would not get out otherwise. This was nominated for an Academy Award. It's called Street Fight. And it looks at the campaign for mayor in Newark, New Jersey, between this, you know, four-term incumbent Sharp James mayor, who's, you know, entrenched in the community, and this young guy, Cory Booker, who's a Rhodes Scholar and, you know, really wanted to infuse Newark with some, you know, life and new vision. And really, this film really is a microcosm for, you know, black politics and you know, the next wave of, you know, what we're going to see in the Democratic Party kind of going forward.
Hmm. Interesting. Do you really think that this movie is a predictor?
Well, I think it looks at the issues. I mean, you in this film, you've got two candidates and, you know, two black candidates, and, you know, there's the issue of how black is Cory Booker. You know, he's a fairer skin, and, you know, it's just like, it's a mind-blowing issue, and it's like you look at incumbents and these people who you know.
This is an issue, by the way, that the African American community is very conscious of. I think most whites are not.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, even Democratic incumbents who have held their spot for a long, long time, and you know, this need for new ideas and new energy to come into the party, and even resistance against some people who, you know, we've depended on for years and years and years to say, well, you know, this is a real battle between the old guard and the new energy and how the two square off. And in Newark, that squared off in a quote-unquote street fight where each candidate, you know, door-to-door took the streets and campaigned. Really, I mean, again, this is one of those movies I think people should really see because it's a real microcosm where I think we're going.
Fantastic. And also out on DVD now, there's a couple of others that you think are worthy of mention. We have about a minute left to wrap it up here.
Greatest Game Ever Played, which is a look at the 1913 U.S. Open between an amateur, Francis Ongwae, and Harry Vaughan, the great professional golfer. This is directed by Bill Paxton, who, you know, you wouldn't think of as a great golf movie director, but he is, and it's a great action film.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, a reminder, we here in Portland where we are, there's a Cirque du Soleil playing, and a lot of Cirque du Soleil movie shows are out on DVD, and they're a lot of fun to check out. And there's one called The Fire Within, which comes from a Bravo series, which looks at behind the scenes. So some interesting stuff out this week.
Behind the scenes in Cirque du Soleil. I saw the Max, what was the giant theaters, you know, that are 6 feet high and round?
Yeah, the IMAX.
IMAX, yeah. I saw a Cirque du Soleil piece in an IMAX theater in Australia, and that's as close as I've ever gotten to him, but that was mind-boggling.
Yeah, so. And The Fire Within looks at the people who, you know, it's a whole 14-episode series which looks at the people who make these shows, and it's really, it's an incredible look at that whole world.
Fascinating. Jeffrey Kleinman, editor of DVD Talk, an online magazine, DVDTalk.com, the website. You can check it out for these DVDs and more. Jeffrey, thank you for being with us.
Thanks.
27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartmann Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
I've heard newborn babies crying like a moaning dove. An old man with broken teeth, stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And welcome back. The place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartmann Radio Program, 34 minutes past the hour. And we'll provide you with shelter from the storm, absolutely. Over at the gay, lesbian, and transgendered website, page 1Q, there's an interesting story. Yes, our Ann Coulter theme music. Yeah, this from page1q.com. Ann Coulter neglects to answer gender question on voter registration form. Article by Michael Rogers. This, again, from the gay, lesbian, and transgendered website. A great website, by the way, for support of people in the GLBT community. And conservative commentator and best-selling author Ann Coulter neglected to answer question number 15 on her Palm Beach County, Florida voter registration form, page 1Q has learned. The question asks the registrant to indicate sex by checking M or F on the form. Bloggers and comment posts have speculated about Coulter's gender identity. And speaking as somebody who's met her, I have some questions as well. Coulter's registration form was first posted by BradBlog.com, the blog of voting rights activist and journalist Brad Friedman. Friedman reported Tuesday that Coulter's registration form raised questions about her decision to register and vote at an address where she did not live. Now, it's interesting to take on this. I object, said a transgendered activist who spoke with Page One Q today, to the state of Florida expecting its citizens to answer questions which are not relevant for voter registration. When asked about Coulter's voter registration form, the activist declined to speak specifically about Coulter, and saying, generally speaking, I hope there's a day when transgendered people can be open about who they are without fear of retribution from employers, colleagues, and neighbors. With that in mind, I hope anyone with a high media profile would use that opportunity to be honest with the American people. I agree. So, Ann Coulter, you know, let us know. Were you born a man or a woman? Or actually, you know, I shouldn't. Well, if it was anybody other than Ann Coulter, I wouldn't ask the question. I just have to say that she is part of this machine that makes a living bashing people, bashing minorities like transgendered people. And so I think that we can safely say there's a slightly different standard. By the way, thanks to Keith Tucker. He sent a great cartoon facts. Keith Tucker is the guy who, whatnowtunes.com, www.whatnowtunes.com. And he noted that we are beginning the fourth year of this radio program this month. We've finished 3 years. It's our third anniversary. It's beginning our fourth. And he says, thanks for everything, Tom. Keith Tucker, 4 more years, you have my vote. That's great. WhatNowTunes.com. And there's some just great cartoons over there as well. So, you know, check it out, WhatNowTunes.com. And just as an update, this Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, I will be... you know, if the television gods are willing or unwilling, as the case may be, on the Heartland with John Kasich on Fox News, talking with or debating or yelling or what we'll find out with John or Michael Smirkanish. So yeah, we'll see how all this shakes out. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. In a few minutes, Dr. Louis Malmadrona is going to be with us. He's got an incredible new book out and doing some workshops and whatnot. But first, Ed in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great, great. What's up?
I wanted to discuss a little bit about an irony that I see. I recall some folks talking about how the Silverstein person who owned the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm. Larry Silverstein.
Yeah, I remember a story about how he had some insurance evaluation coming up, and he had to renew his insurance for the World Trade Towers, and something about it, about how he couldn't because he was going to have to retrofit the building because of all the asbestos, and the, you know, it had been built years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that had been being done and being required, so as insurance changes, so these things change. And then 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And now that I hear the story about the cleanup, you know, I just I've taken hazmat training.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the hazards of various chemicals and their combinations, especially. And I just I don't know. It bothers me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very suspicious, frankly, of conspiracy theories that involve Larry Silverstein. And here's why. Popular Mechanics actually did a pretty good debunking of some of the theories. They obviously didn't answer even half of the questions that are out there, and they didn't at all get into the questions about what did the Bush administration know and when did they know it. And that, in my opinion, is the really big set of questions. But the issue of the steel and the controlled explosions and all that kind of thing, and at least on Towers 1 and 2, if you watch the videos on the web and those kinds of things, they will point out to you that steel doesn't melt until it gets to 2,000 or 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It takes an incredible temperature for steel to melt, and that burning diesel fuel is only now I'm doing these numbers from memory, so it's either 1,300 or 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit, which is nowhere close to what it takes to melt steel, and therefore the theory goes, the burning jet fuel could not have caused the building to begin collapsing.
I've heard that the burning office equipment and paper and all that sort of stuff contributed also.
Well, yeah, but paper burns at 700 degrees Fahrenheit, more or less. So, but what those sites don't tell you is that at the 1,300 or 1,700 degrees, whichever it is, that is the ignition temperature of diesel fuel, under sustained conditions over a period of 20 or 30 minutes, steel will lose 90% of its strength.
Yeah.
So even though it hasn't liquefied, it's lost 90% of its strength. And once the couple of floors there that were on fire collapsed onto themselves, then, you know, you had the weight of everything above them just pushing down on what was below it, and the result was fairly predictable and inevitable. It doesn't answer for me, to my satisfaction, you know, what happened with Building 7. It's still a question. But still, you know, although they make that same point, that there was essentially quasi-legal electric generators in Building 7 that were used for power, and they had these quasi-legal fuel sources. Actually, you know, the Popular Mechanics article makes it seem quite reasonable that Building 7 would have come down. Again, I'm not putting out my opinion on that other than to say, you know, I think that if we're spending all our time looking at Larry Silverstein, we're looking in the wrong place. We need to be looking at the Bush administration, not as, gee, they caused this, so much as what did they know that could have prevented this? Because I am convinced that these guys knew that this was coming and that they could have stopped it. And this is the reason why George W. Bush took the longest presidential vacation in history and why he refused to go back to Washington, D.C. even after that. He went to Florida, where his brother put the entire state on emergency status. And, you know, it just, you know, it concerns me. And I realize, and I got to move along, Ed, but thank you for thanks for the call and bringing it up. But, you know, I realize that, you know, Bush has made statements that raise a lot of, you know, questions in a lot of people's minds. You know, his statement about he saw the first plane hit the tower, for example, when we know that there were no cameras watching when the first plane hit the first tower. Wasn't possible. I mean, actually, there was a tourist camera, some French tourist, but that film didn't show up for a day and a half. And so the video that all of us saw on TV that day that got played over and over and over again was the second tower being hit because the networks didn't train their cameras on the two towers until after the first tower had been hit. Then everybody was looking at it. And yet Bush said something quite different, which was impossible.
Well, George, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I...
There's the thing. You know, I saw, he's talking about the first plane, and it's simply not possible. And well, he continues.
Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when
Sorry
I heard about
that.
The terrorist
we'll have to hear it
attack.
Again.
I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower. The TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And it said it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
Yeah. And, you know, so I just think that's Bush being a very facile liar. You know, as Harry Taylor was on the other day saying, you know, he's a very nice guy. He seems like a very nice guy, like a guy you want to have a beer with. I think he's just a very competent liar. Craig in Tacoma, we have just a few seconds, Craig. Quick point.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out the shakeup at Popular Mechanics prior to the 9/11 debunking article that came out, and the fact that Benjamin Chertoff, the nephew or cousin of Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff, is the editor. So.
Oh, you're kidding.
Of course not. Why would I have to lie about such propaganda?
I am banging my head against the table. Amazing. Well, Craig, thank you. Yeah, Craig, thank you very much. I got to tell you, we have the smartest listeners in the entire world, and I am so grateful for it. Oh, well, we'll continue. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You may say I'm a demon, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Lewis, Dr. Lewis Belmadrona is with us. Dr. Lewis Belmadrona, the author, the first book you wrote, Coyote Healing.
Coyote
Medicine.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Right. And it was just an absolutely remarkable book and has a following. That was years ago you wrote that.
That came out in 97. Right.
97. That has quite a that has influenced so many people.
That's great to hear.
To get into medicine. In fact, my daughter was telling me that a friend of hers is in medical school right now as a result of having read that book.
How about
Yeah, it's just incredible.
That's great. That makes me happy.
Yeah, it's a marvelous book, and you have a new book out, and this new book is called
Coyote Wisdom.
Coyote Wisdom.
And right.
The premise, and actually, before we get through the whole thing, I just want to let folks know that Dr. Lewis Belmadrona, MD, PhD, you got your medical degree at Stanford University?
Right.
And then went back and got a PhD in psychology.
Right.
And so you're a psychiatrist?
Right.
And now you're teaching medicine, right?
And psychiatry.
And
both,
psychiatry.
Both teaching family medicine and psychiatry.
And you've taught alternative medicine mm-hmm. down in Tucson. You were down
right.
there with Dr. Andrew Weil teaching.
Right.
And I, you know, point of what is it when you're up front about something, revelation or whatever. Lewis and I are old friends, so it just so people know. But coyotehealing.info is your website.
Right.
So if people want more information about this, and also you have some healing retreats coming up, one in Mexico and one in Saskatoon, Canada.
Right.
And in February of 2007, so more information about that, coyotehealing.info. Lewis, what fascinates me most about your new book, Coyote Wisdom, is this whole concept of stories. You know, I have written about this in my books on ADHD, you know, that the stories we tell ourselves are our fate. You take it a step farther.
Right. Well, and really what we're saying is that we're all living out stories, and that from the moment we're conceived, people start telling stories about us, and from the time we can understand language, we start to internalize these stories about ourselves, and that's what we live. And, of course, you've talked about the power of story in politics, that if you don't have a good story, you don't get elected.
Yeah.
You know, which is why we think the Democrats have an election disorder.
There you go. Yes. And you're Native American,
right.
And your ancestry is one that is very grounded in story, and you've brought that to this book, that story isn't just who we are, that story, the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves and our place in the world defines whether or not we heal.
Exactly. That's the indigenous or the Native American perspective, is that since all we are is story, as some writers, Native American writers say, then the story that you live determines that's whether you're sick or well is part of that story.
Hmm.
And in order to get well, you may have to change your story. So that if your story is one that everybody's always taking advantage of you and nothing ever turns out and isn't life awful and I always expect the worst, well, maybe you have to change that story.
Or you'll get what your story is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we can't do it alone. That's the other point, is that I think the New Age makes the mistake of saying everybody should work on themselves by themselves.
Right.
And really the indigenous or the native point of view is, it's all community.
Yeah, I have heard. I actually heard a woman I was at a conference where some New Age kind of healing person was talking, and so this woman stood up and spoke about a cancer that she had, and the speaker essentially blamed her for her own cancer.
Right.
And I thought, you know, how can you blame her for maybe living next to a toxic factory or something? But you're suggesting that there's this whole thing about community. I want to tell us the story about this. There's one story in the book that I found really compelling about the patient with anorexia.
Oh, right. That was a really interesting woman because she was a perfectionist. She wanted to be the best at anything that she did, and so she won an international prize in her previous activity. I think it was dance.
Mm-hmm.
And then she thought, well, there's nowhere to go here, so what am I going to do next? And she was looking around, and she found an anorexia website. And she said, oh, I think I'll become an anorexic. And of course,
now,
she was
didn't
always,
literally think this at the top
she
of her
really thought that.
Oh, she really did.
She really did.
Okay.
She really did. She
and
said,
she became the world's best anorexic and in the process
absolutely.
Nearly killed herself.
Right.
And
right.
she ended up coming to you and,
right.
and what you did was changed her story.
We changed her story. We just started brainstorming. Well, all right, so what's really cool about anorexia? And she said, well, the really cool thing is that people look at you and they think, oh, my God, I could never diet like that. Look at how perfect she is. Look at how she succeeded at what all of us fail at doing, mm-hmm. losing weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question was, well, so what else could you do to be perfect? I mean, there's mm-hmm. got to be something else. And she, then as we started to scan through her life, we came up with horses.
Mm-hmm.
She really loved to ride horses. And so she said, well, I could get a prize in horses. I got a prize in dance. I could get a prize in horses. And so that made sense. You know, she said, well, I could be perfect. I could be a perfect horse. I mean, I could do dressage. I could be perfect at dressage.
But you can't do that if you're anorexic because you'll fall off the horse because you're
right.
like a feather.
That's right. So she had to beef herself up. She had to get thigh muscles to hang
right.
onto the saddle.
Right.
And so she did.
That's,
she said, oh, well, I could do that.
So changing her story literally healed her.
Right. Right, and she didn't actually have to look for any intra-psychic things.
Extraordinary. The book, Coyote Wisdom, the website, coyotehealing.info, Dr. Louis Melmadrona. Louis, so great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for showing up. Don't miss on Monday our debate with conservative Tom Strobar. I'll be asking, why are so many conservatives afraid of gays? Will Durst, the comic and actor, is going to be with us from San Francisco's The Quake. He and I are going to tell all and confess why we're liberals. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And as always, my friends, remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. I'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.